This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham. Today, I'm talking to Colm Kenny, whose Kinmare, History and Survival, Father John O'Sullivan and the Famine Poor has just been published by Eastwood Books. Now, Colm, you'd be very familiar to History Ireland readers for your work on Arthur Griffith. And of course, last year you published The Enigma of Arthur Griffith, Father of Us All, which was very well received. So my first question is, what brought you to write a book about Kinmare?
What's brought me to this book really is a combination of a personal interest, but also a fascination with the famine itself, which I think, despite a growing number of studies, is an area that's rich for historians in terms of understanding Ireland as it is today. The personal aspect is the fact that my late grandmother, who'd been born in Tralee, left among a few papers in the family a handwritten copy of a letter that the parish priest of Kenmare had printed during the Great Famine and circulated. And that had been there for 50 years almost. And I had picked it up from time to time and read of this man's deep concern about the condition of his people and his clash with a local landlord and proselytizer at Dromore Castle. And I had kept meaning to go back to it sometime and really had done a little bit of work. But when the COVID lockdown came along, I picked it up one day and I thought, this is really, I'm going to have to find out more about what was happening in Kinmare at that time and why this man intervened and what it meant to the people who lived there. He had a vivid relationship with a local workhouse, O'Sullivan. So that brought me on to see what I could do. And it's been instructive to discover just how much was possible, actually, despite the COVID lockdown in terms of research.
Now, just how did this end up in your grandmother's possession, this particular document?
I think it's a sign. Well, the short answer is I'm not quite sure, but it seems to me indicative of the importance of O'Sullivan to the popular memory in Kerry. They were distantly related. Both of them had an ancestor, a shared ancestor, on O'Sullivan's mother's side, who was a ship's captain in Dingle, who used to take butter to Lisbon and coal from Liverpool to Dingle, and who unfortunately at one point went down with his ship and was never seen again. So I suppose there was a family connection. And I know that Father O'Sullivan himself had celebrated the marriage of my grandmother's grandmother during the Great Famine. So I guess she had a particular interest. But when I looked into it, I began to see that, you know, there are stories that don't always get recorded that are told locally. And when you get to Kenmare, you hear fond recollections passed down of O'Sullivan and what he did for and with the poor people of Kenmare. And it was unusual.
So, Colm, that means you're two or three handshakes away from this man?
Oh, I probably think it's a little bit more than that, perhaps. Maybe four or five.
Okay. Not Elvis, Father John O'Sullivan we're talking about here. Now, yeah. Just before we talk about Father John O'Sullivan, just talk to us a little bit about Kinmare. When was it founded and by whom?
Yes, this is a great source of confusion, because it was indeed founded by William Petty, but not the William Petty that's often mentioned as having founded it, including by Macaulay, the English historian. The William Petty who was granted a great deal of land, the Cromwellian William Petty of the Down Survey, who got tens of thousands of acres in Kerry, did indeed found a small settlement near Kenmare, which was almost wiped out in the 1680s, although about 150 settlers returned subsequently. But it was his grandson, the William Petty, who became briefly Prime Minister of Britain and who was made the first Lord Lansdowne because of his role in securing a peaceful resolution of the American Revolution. He's the man who in the late 1700s actually founded the town of Kenmare and came up with the name of it.
Now, one thing has always intrigued me. I mean, even with my Leaving Cert Irish, I can translate Kenmare as head of the sea or something like that, which is, you know, it's at the end of it. But why is it called Nedeen in the Irish language?
That's right. That is the original title. And it was called Nedeen by many people, even in written form, well into the 1800s. But Petty didn't want that. It could mean little nest, but the whether the een at the end is the diminutive for little in Irish, the common diminutive, or whether it's a reference to Fionn and the Fianna is a local debate that goes on. Because there are a lot of name places and folklore in the area associated with the Fianna and Usheen and Fionn. But that was the name. I mean, and it remains the Irish language name, of course. But Petty, when he founded the town, wanted something a little bit more attractive to English people. He hoped to build up business there, and he thought it better to give it an English name.
Now, just going back to Macaulay, right? Because you've lots to say about Macaulay. So he does give the place a bad press. Just talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. But Macaulay, there's a cliche used about Macaulay frequently, even by established historians, that he was a great English historian. He was, of course, a fantastic ideologue. And there's a wonderful new book about Macaulay by Sullivan, published recently, that traces some of the way in which he constructed his great four-volume history of England. Now, in that four-volume history of England, of course, he has references to Ireland. And remarkably, he has quite a substantial digression about Kenmare. And that's partly because Macaulay was basically given a seat in Parliament by Lord Lansdowne, who was a great Whig politician and organiser in the 19th century. And Macaulay was also related through marriage. His sister married Charles Trevelyan, the Trevelyan corn man, who played an important role during the famine. And he wrote a version of the history of Kenmare, which I have deconstructed in this book. I didn't expect to do that when I started out, but the more I read, the more fascinated I became. Macaulay was heavily criticised for his history references to Ireland. He depended heavily on a few biased sources. And he did so in order to construct a version of British imperialism which would flatter the English establishment, basically, in London. And he left a version of Kenmare's history that makes it look basically as if the Irish had very little to do with the area, and that it was largely a creation of settlers. And I think I've successfully managed to put his version into context. I hope so, anyway.
Now, another well-known historian who features is Froude. What's his connection with Kenmare?
He came there and rented a house on the Lansdowne estate for 3 years. The area, in fact, where he used to come and write outdoors became known as Froude's Seat on the Bera Peninsula, which is part of the Kenmare Union. But his version of Irish history, of course, is also highly suspect, as is well known. He wrote a novel about the area based on the history of the settlers, which was savaged by Oscar Wilde, who wrote some remarkably amusing and very insightful historic reviews of historical works. I quote that in the book, Wilde's criticism of Froude. And it is all rather amusing. But again, he Froude depended on Macaulay, as have so many others who've written since Macaulay wrote.
Now, let's get back to Father John O'Sullivan. Who was he, Colin?
He was from Tralee, and he grew up in Tralee. His father died when he was quite young, and his mother reared him there. And he always seemed to have a desire to become a priest. One of the things that has interested me is the way in which I think the disfavor the frowning upon of the Catholic Church that has become common now because of the sins of some of its members, both recently in terms of child abuse and previously in terms of the abuse of power within this state. There is a danger that we lose sight of the work and the role of men like John O'Sullivan, who were very close to the people and did a great deal to build up their communities. Some of them, like O'Sullivan, would later be eclipsed by the hierarchy who built a superstructure on the local structures that they had created educationally. But he grew up in Tralee, and he became came to the attention of Cornelius Egan, the Bishop of Kerry, who helped to fund him to go to Maynooth to train as a priest. And he seemed to have been quite clever, and he was earmarked for further study in Maynooth. But there was such a shortage of priests to serve the needs of the Irish at the time that Cornelius Egan decided he was needed in Kerry. And he was sent, first of all, as a curate to Dingle, where he worked for 10 years. And it's quite interesting. You mentioned Irish language earlier. It's an illustration of how there are variations in the proficiency in the Irish language. Tralee didn't seem to be great at the Irish language, and O'Sullivan had a very poor grasp of it until he actually became a priest and had to learn it. And he complained quite a bit about his difficulties in that respect. But Cornelius Egan insisted that he brush up on it, and he came to have to use it very often in his work in the county.
Now, there's an overlap with the last book interview I did with Brian McMahon on his Faith and Fury book on the evangelical campaign in West Dingle. And of course, O'Sullivan has a small part in that. Just talk to us a little bit about that, because he was involved in a very controversial excommunication in 1837.
Well, yes, he was very fierce. Although he had a lot of Protestant friends and thanked Protestants for having helped his family when his father died, and he continued to be well regarded by many of the members of the Church of Ireland, he certainly didn't hold back when it came to anything he regarded like proselytism. And he wasn't afraid to excommunicate people if he felt that they were having anything to do with the Protestant proselytizers on the Dingle Peninsula.
So this particular excommunication was for a woman who sent her child to a Protestant school. I mean, she herself didn't even convert, and she was excommunicated for that. You know, so it was a pretty they're pretty sharp exchanges there in West Kerry at that time. Now, next question is: did O'Sullivan coin the term "super"?
Certainly, there is no.
Maybe explain the term, just in case any of our listeners don't know what "super" means.
Yes, of course. The term "super" comes from. The term super comes from the fact that Protestant missionaries or clergy used to hand out soup and food to Catholics on occasion. And whether you saw this as an act of charity or whether you saw it as an insidious attempt to induce people to leave their faith, of course, is very much an act of opinion. Some people think the extent of proselytism was exaggerated, but these people were soon became known as supers. It was a derogatory term that the Catholics applied to them. It may be that O'Sullivan was the very man who coined it. Certainly there's evidence in the Folklore Commission that some of the people at Kerry thought that he had coined the phrase, but I wouldn't like to claim that I could stand that up. I don't know how anybody could, but it was about his time in Dingle that it was first used, apparently, and it continued to be used as a term throughout Ireland for a long time.
Now, just what do O'Sullivan's journals tell us about the Kenmare area? Just getting back to Kenmare, what sort of a place was it?
Yeah, this is one of the wonderful things that, I mean, I discovered the extent to which O'Sullivan did write. And we have these journals. Some may have been lost, but in Killarney, in the diocesan archive, these still exist, and they well deserve to be published. They have received some attention, but not nearly enough. And they provide wonderful pictures of Kerry, of the diocese, of the people in it, of the poor, of other priests. It's very colourful material, and it's very well written. And I've been dipping into these. The diocesan library very kindly managed to allow me in during COVID. And again, may I say here, as an historian, new technology can be very helpful. When you are given access like that and you're permitted to use your phone to take copies, I mean, if you only have 3 or 4 days down in Killarney to do this, you know, the mobile phone is a wonderful thing to make hundreds of copies of pages if you're permitted to then work at them at home on your computer. And this was a great assistance to me. And I must say, I'm very grateful both to the Diocesan Archive and to Tralee County Library, where they have fantastic workhouse minutes of Kerry. I mean, they have volume after volume of the workhouse minutes from Kenmare. And again, they managed to get me copies of a couple of hundred, you know, pages that I particularly wanted to see at times when, during COVID, when otherwise it would have been impossible to read them. So that has been wonderful.
Well, what does he have to say about faction fighting, for example?
Yeah, well, there's been a recent book published about faction fighting in Kerry, As It Happens, and I discovered that there was a Silesian prince who was visiting Kenmare on his way to see Daniel O'Connell, and he found himself right in the middle of these faction fights, having his dinner in the middle of the day in a hotel in Kenmare, watching these out the window. He even went outside afterwards and got himself bought himself one of the weighted blackthorns. The blackthorns weighted with lead, the shillelaghs, I suppose we might say, that were being used. And they were a ferocious part of the culture in rural Ireland, including in that part of Kerry in the early 19th century. One of the things the church was trying to stamp out, of course, in terms of the kind of traditional peasant mode of celebration of events.
Well, it still goes on. Just all the complaining about the recent, you know, the crowds at Croke Park and so on, right? These issues are still with us. Now, moving on to more serious matters, Colm, how did the famine affect the Kenmare area and how did O'Sullivan respond?
The Kenmare area was not very rich to begin with. I mean, that part of the country had been long run down. The poverty, again, the poor didn't leave records. They didn't speak for themselves. And this is why it's so interesting to try to hear the voices of the people in these areas. When you look at the study of housing in Ireland that was commissioned in the 1840s, and you see the vast numbers of people who just lived in one-room cabins, and that was the kind of background in which the potato famine hit. And devastated the people around Kenmare. They were dying in the streets. And O'Sullivan was a very practical man. He didn't wait around. He started to, first of all, organise a supply of food. Not free food at first. I mean, this is one of the interesting things. He was quite a practical man. His first impulse was just to get more food into the area, to bring down the price for people. But eventually he realized that wasn't enough. So he took himself off to London and he managed to get not one, but two hearings in person in front of the great British Relief Organization that was founded by the bankers on Threadneedle Street, many of them Jews, one of whom he became a correspondent of. And indeed, it's said that when he built his church in Kenmare after the famine, the incidence of the Star of David in it some local people believe was a tribute to the way in which the Jewish bankers helped him. When he met them, they had only met one or two people in person. They weren't in the business because they were very busy men. They were meeting nearly every night at that period to get relief for Ireland. And he also befriended Charles Trevelyan. He even stayed with Trevelyan in his home. I mean, he was an astonishing, for a local parish priest, he went to astonishing lengths and seemed to have been very capable in a quiet sort of way. He also got himself in before a select committee of the House of Commons and gave evidence there.
Now, Trevelyan is normally seen as the villain of the piece here. I mean, what sort of relationship did O'Sullivan have with him? I mean, did he get anything from Trevelyan from these meetings? You know, any benefits?
He believed he did. He believed it opened doors for him and helped him to get aid sent and helped. It was a form of leverage. It was a status thing as much as anything. That when he went to meet the bankers, for instance, the Rothschilds and people like that, that, you know, the fact he had been staying with Trevelyan or met him was helpful. And Trevelyan was in correspondence with him. He used to send him blue books, parliamentary reports. And again, O'Sullivan felt that helped him with the officials on the ground in Ireland, that this made him look good. I'm not sure whether you could measure, you know, in pounds, shillings, and pence, exactly what he got out of Trevelyan, but there is correspondence between them, some of it surviving in Newcastle University that I was able to have a look at. So it certainly counted for something and was unusual. He wasn't the only parish priest in communication with Trevelyan. I mean, the parish priest of Skibbereen was too, and I know my father Matthew, the apostle of temperance and others. They were an interesting breed. They were building up on their own a church structure in Ireland and helping. They saw their people as dying out and needing all kinds of material support, and they were very pragmatic about how they went about getting that. He had to play Lord Lansdowne, the powerful local descendant of Petty, who owned tens of thousands of acres, never visited the area during the Great Famine. And he had to play him very carefully. He had to balance all sides and manage a very difficult political and social situation.
Now, how would you describe O'Sullivan's politics? Because you've painted a picture here of an immensely practical, pragmatic man on the one hand, yet on the other, he excommunicates this poor woman in Dingle for sending her child to a Protestant school. It seems contradictory.
Yes, he is. And I think that, you know, it's good to recognize these contradictions in people like him in Ireland at that period. He was a bare repealer. Like when forced to decide, he kind of said, okay, well, I'm in favor of repeal. But the Tories, on the other hand, saw him as Lord Lansdowne's pet. He wasn't a radical political activist. He was probably somewhat conservative on tenant rights. But on the other hand, he was very insistent, and I think this is quite radical, on the right of the poor to relief, not charity. He stressed this to Parliament a number of times. He felt they had an, and that was quite a radical thing in those days. He didn't like secret societies. He condemned Young Ireland, but he also, there was a controversy later on with the Phoenix Society, the Fenians, I suppose. He gave information to Dublin Castle. He thought he was doing the right thing. He wanted it stopped in his area because he thought young men were going to suffer as a result of it. But it rebounded badly against him, and it looked very bad. He seemed to pass on information he'd been given, if not in the confession, then contingent to the confession. O'Donovan Rossa was very critical about that and published some correspondence he managed to get hold of between. So, you know, he's not a plaster cast saint, you know, but neither is he a villain. He's just a very interesting individual working out these contradictions as best he could, you know, for his organization, the church, and also for the poor people who had very few people to help them.
Now, there's an interesting one. I don't normally stray into the area of theology here in these interviews column, right? But the Immaculate Conception, right? Because he had a rather nuanced view on this. Now, I wanted to explain to listeners that there's always confusion about what the Immaculate Conception means. It isn't the fact that, you know, the Virgin Mary was a virgin. It's the idea that she was born without original sin, right? Has everyone got that, right? Now, this became a church dogma, when was it? In the 1860s. But O'Sullivan was opposed to this. Just explain why, because it doesn't fit in with the other picture we have of him as this kind of, you know, fire-breathing, you know, anti-evangelical cleric, you know. Just explain what was his position. It seems a rather nuanced one.
Yeah, well, thank you for not asking me to explain the Immaculate Conception, first of all. Yes, I think there's two things going on. You know, there was this conflict between, if you like, the priests on the ground in Ireland, who had a fairly straightforward, simple view of what religion should be about, and increasingly the hierarchical church of Cullen and MacHale, with whom O'Sullivan clashed when he represented the Bishop of Kerry at the Synod of Thurles. And they were more and more trying to restrict the practices of the existing church. They wanted to do away with the stations, the way the priests went out on call. They wanted to concentrate all church activity into church buildings. And when it came to things like the Immaculate Conception, they were imposing from the top a view of religion that O'Sullivan thought was basically unnecessary. He had said, you know, how come we never had to learn about these dogmas in Maynooth College when we went there? How come suddenly people are obliged to believe them? How did it happen that until within the last few years we never heard of such things? And it certainly startled me, he said, when I first heard it, for I never dreamt that anyone believed the Blessed Virgin to be immaculate, be conceived, until we were called upon some years ago to recite that office. So he felt it, I think, that it was putting people on a pedestal, where his was more the religion of, you know, ordinary person, grounded in an everyday experience rather than abstract theory. And it was a radical thing to do, but he was burning bridges by this stage in ways. He was antagonizing, you know, Cullen and MacHale more and more. He had crossed them at the Synod of Thurles, and they would prevent him becoming Bishop of Kerry. The priests, in fact, were to vote for him to become Bishop of Kerry, and the Munster bishops were to support him. But because of some of his, if you like, more colourful activities and statements, they stopped him ever getting that role and gave it instead to Moriarty, who was a much more conservative and kind of an individual in every sense.
Now, when did he pass away?
He passed away in 1874.
So he would have witnessed the whole reemergence of the Catholic Church, you know, the church building. So he would have witnessed this edifice that he partly tried to build. And of course, the irony being then that he didn't get the big job when it came his way.
That's right. He had built over a dozen national schools locally, and then he got the nuns in as well to found a convent. I mean, again, we might think now the nuns very conservative and all of that, but in those days they were seen as a very liberating force, bringing education and training to women and others. And he built the church and he managed to raise the finance for the church in Kenmare without imposing on the parishioners themselves in any way. And it's a very fine building, you know, into which, you know, he put a lot of effort at the time. But as you say, he didn't, if you like, get the benefit on a personal level by being made bishop. And that's where I just wonder, there aren't later journals and you would expect them to be. So I don't know if they were lost along the way somehow.
Now, you mentioned nuns there, Colm. You have a chapter devoted to women here. Just talk to us about that a bit.
Oh, yeah, I very much wanted to do this because they're always there in history, women, even if they're not mentioned. Naturally, I don't mean to sound in any sense patronising. I wanted to draw out the attitudes towards women and the role that women played in that area. There were very active people, not just the nuns. They were among one of the most active proselytisers, the wife of the landlord at Dromore Castle. Was known as Yellow Kate, and he clashed with her over proselytism. But there were remarkable things to be learned about attitudes towards women in the workhouse minutes, where there was a whole penitential section of the workhouse into which women, single mothers and women, fallen women, had to go, and they were carefully separated lest they pollute the other women in the institution. And I was very happy to find in a second-hand bookshop in Shrewsbury, actually some drawings of women in Kenmare by a visiting English artist, Teresa Marrable, which I acquired, and I've included a couple of them in the book. But, you know, I think it's a significant part of the book for me that I was able to do this.
Now, that brings me on to my final point, because O'Sullivan lived long enough to be photographed, and there's a photograph of him. Fine big beard on, he's a very striking looking man. And this is a beautifully illustrated book. You've mentioned some of those drawings there. So that's Kenmare, History and Survival, Father John O'Sullivan and the Famine Poor. I've just been talking to Colm Kenny, and that book is published by Eastwood Books, available in all good bookshops. Now, listeners, our next Hedge School will be on prisons and prisoners during the War of Independence, and that will be posted on the 9th of September, centenary of the mass breakout of IRA prisoners from Rath internment camp in the Curragh. Colm Kenny, thank you very much for talking to you about this very interesting man. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.